District Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:02 p.m. on Monday, March 24th, 2025. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Costello, Representative Mina, Representative Eichheit, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. As a courtesy, I ask everyone to please silence your cell phones. I'd also like to take a moment to recognize the staff supporting this meeting. We have Sophia Tenney from House Records, Susan Quickly from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Nate Graham. I will also acknowledge for the record that we've been joined by Representative Will Stapp. We have two items on today's agenda. We will first begin with a final consideration of House Bill 62, the Sexual Assault Examination Kits Bill. And then we will have a hearing of House Bill 51 by Representative Will Stapp. So back to House Bill 62, Sexual Assault Examination Kits. An amendment deadline was set, and our office received no amendments. At this time, I would like to invite the Department of Public Safety, Commissioner Cockrell, and his special assistant, Laurel Shoup, to come forward and make any closing comments before we take up the bill. I'd like to acknowledge that we were joined by Representative Underwood at 1:04 p.m. Mr. Cockrell.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I want to introduce Laura Soup, my special assistant. Thank you for having the opportunity to kind of close this out. When I look at what we're doing here, is we all should have ownership of this. It is certainly to my heart that this needs to be taken care of. We've recognized the gap. We've made some huge strides in how we handle sexual assaults in the state. Before it was disastrous, now I think we're on par with any other state. And this just closes that gap that we've been seeking, just gives us timelines set for our victims to know exactly where they're at, gives them a chance, an opportunity to look at where their sexual assault kit is in the process. That way nothing will ever fall through. And we're pleading with you to pass this bill through and get it through the rest of the session. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was Commissioner James Cockrell for the record.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Laurel Shoup going to make any comments?
Sure. For the record, Laurel Shoup, thank you, Chair Gray, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this very important bill. Alaska has made huge strides in their sexual assault examination kit tracking system. This bill would seek to codify that tracking system and ensure transparency in what we currently do for our victims so they have that assurity that we are addressing this very important issue in our state. So please help us codify this important bill today.
Thank you both so much. Are there any final questions from committee members? Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Commissioner, and your staff for all the work and commitment that you've put into this. And it's something that I think is critically important to the state of Alaska. And I just wanted to let you know that. I'm sure the committee feels that way too, but it's really wonderful to have your leadership doing this. Thank you.
Through the chair, James Cockrell, Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Any other questions or comments from committee? Then at this time, I would like to entertain a motion. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 62, Work Order 34-LS1317/A from the Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
We will now take an at-ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, I just wanted to state for the record that we saw no objection to House Bill 62, Work Order 34-LS1317/alpha, and we moved it from the Judiciary Committee with its individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes. And we have signed the paperwork. We will now have our first hearing of House Bill 51, the spending cap, and it is my intention to hear from the bill's sponsor, to hear the sexual analysis and a brief presentation. We will then entertain questions from the committee. At that point, we will set the bill aside and bring it up for invited and public testimony at a later date. I would now like to invite Representative Will Stapp and his staff, Henry Thompson, to the front to introduce the bill.
(Clears throat) Well, thank you, Chair Gray. For the record, my name is Representative Will Staff. I represent East Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, Badger. That's House District 32, and other members of the committee, thanks for having us here today. And this is my intern, Henry.
And for the record, Henry Thompson, intern for Representative Staff. I'll be presenting the slide presentation. It's a very high-level overview of the spending limit, and then reading the sectional analysis.
And with your permission, Chair, get started.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Members of the committee, so HB 51, so it's kind of a two-parter. I have two bills that kind of are connected to each other. One is a constitutional spending limit. The other is a statutory spending limit. That is HB 51 here in front of us. It's going to be a little wonky because the other bill is in a different committee. So, and you'll see that as we go through the slide in the notes. So what is the nucleus behind HB 51? Well, for those of you who don't know, Alaska has had a constitutional spending limit and a statutory spending limit for a very long time. So after they were established, due to the metric at which they benchmark what a spending cap should be, i.e. population and inflation is the existing cap, they started to get out of alignment with Alaska's actual revenue picture. And as most of you know, that Alaska's revenues are volatile compared to other states that have steady broad-based taxes, especially states that have consumption-based taxes, i.e. sales. And those are very steady kind of areas of revenue. So because our revenue has relied for so long on oil taxes, basically, resource extraction taxes, and that varies wildly based on production and price. It's created scenarios historically in Alaska's really legislative appropriation process where when we have really good years, we increase the spending by a lot. And then, unfortunately, when the prices collapse in our revenue streams, you have to kind of rug pull all the things that you inserted into your budget, especially on the operating side over time. So as we go out through this process, the objective is, okay, what kind of metric can I design with the spending cap to replace the existing one that is really designed to focus on growth indicators in Alaska's economy, i.e., I think we all want a robust and healthy private sector and economy in the state. And if our spending metrics are designed around that, the goal would be to achieve stable and reliability in kind of government services and, of course, growth in the private sector. So that's the overview of HB 51. And now I'll kick it over to my intern to go into more depth.
All right. For the record, Henry Thompson, of course, the bill we're hearing today is the statutory appropriations limit, HB 51. So first I'll go over the current statutory limit. It was enacted in 1986. It's very similar to a constitutional limit that's set currently. The statutory limit stipulates that the appropriations from the Treasury made in a fiscal year should not exceed those made in the previous fiscal year with an increase of 5% plus the change in population and inflation since the preceding fiscal year. Now, the metrics that are used to calculate this are arriving from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and the inflation is calculated using the Anchorage CPI, which is by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The main thing I want to clarify with this slide is that there is a small difference in the statutory limit and the constitutional. That being that the constitutional is based off of a number of $2.5 billion in 1981, which you then adjust according to the change in inflation and change in population since then to kind of you add these scaled adjustments to it, right? So we've had a 250% increase in inflation since then around that. So you'd be adding 250% of 2.5 to the $2.5 billion originally set in the constitutional spending limit. So just a brief difference there to clarify. Now this is a graph that shows the current statutory limit and the historical data, the historical appropriations that have been subject to the limit. The really important thing with this slide is that you can see the current statutory limit is fluctuating rapidly. That's really what happens if you have it based on the previous year's spending. I mean, you can see the spending in any given year if it's an increase, you see the spending limit increases pretty significantly in the following year. One of the benefits of a spending limit is that you're increasing the stability of the government. And the simple fact is if you have a spending limit that's tied to the previous years and can increase by a certain amount, it's really liable to have an increase in volatility. Now, HB 51, this is the proposed spending limit. It's based off of a percentage. It's 12% of a five-year trailing average of real GDP minus government spending. And real GDP, it incorporates inflation and population, which reflect economic growth. It also has a more nuanced sort of value adjustment. So if this one person is producing more, then that's something that's included in real GDP, but not in a metric of change in inflation and change in population. Here you can see there's some stipulations regarding which appropriations are subject and which are excluded. Those that are subject to the limit are the UGF spending, operating and capital, as well as the payments for retirement benefits. There's a sort of an array of items that are excluded, which includes permanent fund dividends. It includes a number of savings items, which are funds that need to be appropriated twice to get to the people. So you appropriate into a fund and then you appropriate out of it. That includes the permanent fund or power cost equalization endowment, appropriations to state savings accounts, and the capitalization of state retirement accounts. There are also a few more erroneous items, such as direct spending for disaster declarations. You, of course, want those to be excluded from the spending limit so that if something bad happens, you can try to remedy it. Proceeds of bonds that are approved by voters and appropriations that are made from the mental health trust settlement income account. Here you can see we've got a lot of data here. This is really to give the committee an idea of exactly what the numbers look like from year to year and to see how we calculate it. So you can see we have Alaska GDP, Alaska government GDP, GDP minus government, and then the five-year trailing average. The calculation that we're proposing, again, is Alaska GDP minus Alaska government GDP, averaged over 5 years, and then 12% of that. So for fiscal year 25, for example, the spending limit, according to the bill, would have been around $5.9 billion. This is another graph. This time it includes the bill's proposed statutory limit. There are a few things to highlight with this graph. You can see that the proposed spending limit is much more consistent than the statutory limit, the current statutory limit. That's results from the five-year trailing average, as well as the other important point, which is that we're using a different metric to calculate the spending cap, which is real GDP minus government spending.
And this slide, and again for the record, Representative Stapp, this slide to me really articulates conceptually what we are trying to achieve through a revised spending cap. And that is, number one, a steady and stable controlled rate of growth in our operational and capital spending that meets Alaska's needs. And when you are in years where you have revenue surplus, what can you do with that money? Well, you can pay off your pension liabilities. You can put the savings into the permanent fund corpus itself. You can pay off other liabilities that you have. But again, the metric is designed so that when you have a period of good years, like we had in FY 9, 10, 11, and 12, that you don't add a bunch of things that you have no ability to kind of maintain long-term payments for, where you don't have a situation where you go in and, like we did under the previous governor in FY 15 and 16, you have to slash back over $1 billion in kind of operational spending. So conceptually, my argument would be everyone wins in the end if you have a stable and controllable metric where We all know that we're going to have really good revenue years in the state based off our current fiscal regime. And we all also understand that we are not always going to have great revenue years. And the key is, what do we want to design to do with those surplus revenues? And paying off debt liability, putting more money into the permanent fund corpus, I think those are very good things for us to do in times of surplus.
All right, that's the end of the slides. I'll now go over the sectional analysis, which is a more precise examination of the changes that are being made here. So Section 1, it amends AS 37.05540B by changing the list of appropriations subject to the limit, and it changes the conditions that determine the appropriation limit. So the new limit, we've stated it a few times already, it's 12% of a five-year trailing average of real GDP minus government spending. Now, the exceptions that are being made to this spending cap are appropriation of general obligation bond proceeds, appropriations of principal and interest on revenue bonds. Then you have the sort of funds that require two appropriations, that require subsequent appropriation is how it's phrased in the law, and appropriations to meet a state of disaster declared by the governor are the exceptions. Now, it sort of restates the conditions we've gone over. These, the 12% of real GDP and the GDP minus government. It removes the old cap. It removes language determining the source of estimation from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and it similarly removes the language prescribing a CPI calculation based on the Anchorage CPI. Section 2 adds a new subsection which requires a comparison of the governor's budget requests, supplemental requests, and budget amendments to be calculated, to be compared to the new appropriation limit. In Section 3, it kind of goes in with excluding disaster response. It sort of changes where it's placed in the law. So Section 3 removes it. In Section 1, it was added. In Section 4, adds a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska that...
So all Section 4 is this conditional language making that this bill basically requires the passage of the other bill in order to become effective. And the reason we would do that, as you know, a statutory spending limit is...
Can you put yourself on the record?
Oh, absolutely. For the record, my name is Representative Bill Staff. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gray. And as I was stating a little bit ago... So the reason you would make the bill conditional on the constitutional limit is because a statutory limit in and of itself has actually no bite. It's the same vote threshold as basically anything else, 2111. And that's also, by the way, when we showed you those charts, even though we had a statutory limit in place, the legislature blew through that many, many, many times in our history. So, and that's Section 4.
Thank you so much. I want to state for the record that we were joined by Vice Chair Kopp at 1:10 p.m. And I believe, is it now time for us to ask questions?
Certainly.
Okay. So I will start with a question for the sponsor. Do you believe that our state's funding needs decline when our revenues decline?
Through the chair to Chair Gray, I guess to Chair Gray, my apologies to the committee. I wouldn't say that's necessarily true, although I know where you're going with the follow-up. So,
I mean, I'll follow up. do our needs fluctuate with the change in oil prices and with the changes in the stock market?
I think that the fundamental state needs remain pretty tied to the individuals and the economy that they're working in. So, but I will say that in order to meet those needs, you do got to have the revenues. So it really depends on how you want to define what's a need and what's a want to an individual.
I think I'll ask my final question, which is really kind of gives my philosophy about the spending cap, which is that the spending cap is tying our spending to a very erratic revenue situation that we have in Alaska. Basically saying that our spending must follow our erratic revenue plan. And I just will state for the record that other states have more stable revenue, and we could have more stable revenue as well, which would therefore allow us to have a more stable funding plan. And so I'm not constitutionally opposed to a spending cap, but I'm constitutionally opposed to tying our spending to a very irrational market in terms of determining what I call it irrational, because sometimes we have tons and tons of money and sometimes we have very, very little money. And that's not because we did something bad or we did something good. It's because sometimes the price of oil is very high and sometimes it's very low. Sometimes our stock market crashes and we don't get the dividends from our from the permanent fund that we were expecting. And I think saying that, you know, if the stock market crashes, then therefore our schools don't need as much money doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, and maybe I could just clarify a couple things for the bill, Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Rep. Stapp. So I would actually argue that you're making a very good case for HB 51. And the reason is our existing spending limit, the one that we currently have in statute, basically does what you say that the problem is. So the existing limit that this bill proposes to change is basically 5% plus population inflation of what we spent last year. So in order to have a metric in which we have a more stable source of our ability to spend, HB 51 looks at our real GDP, which is the total economic output of our state in the private sector. And the concept would be, hey, if the private sector is growing and doing better, and you did want to add different types of tax schemes, well, the best way to do that is to actually have a healthy and not anemic private sector that could bear a burden like that. So I would argue that that's kind of the purpose behind HB 51.
Other questions from committee?
Yes, thank you,
Vice Chair Cobb.
Representative Stapp, thank you for bringing this forward. There's been lots of discussion over decades about how to get this appropriation limit right. One of the things that I see is not subject to this, of course, is the permanent fund dividend. And as you know, that's kind of the tiger we're trying to tame, which can blow any limit that we want to adhere to philosophically out of the water. So I realize that wasn't a question. So the question is, when it comes to like a resolution to put before the voters combining the earnings reserve and the permanent fund and maybe staying with a 5% draw, tell me just philosophically or very in real tangible ways how you would see something like that being a different, you know, obviously it would limit spending compared to what you're proposing here.
Through the chair to Representative Kopp. Excellent question. So it's a bit of a two-parter there. So regarding the permanent fund dividend, last legislative session, the bill was amended to put that under the cap. I don't particularly, it doesn't bother me if people want to put it under the appropriation limit or not. I would say that the way the PFD is going, it probably isn't really going to matter if it's under the cap or not, by the looks of how the spending is going. But that's something that's will of the committee. I have no problem. It just requires us to make some adjustments to the percentages, which is not a big deal. I would say that the PFD appropriation is super wild and varies over the last few years, so it's easier just to do the math with it not being under the cap, and that gives the legislature more prerogative how they kind of want to do these appropriations. My personal opinion would be if you had a big surplus here, it would be a lot better to either pay off retirement liability or invest that in the corpus of the fund. To the second aspect of the question, Representative Kopp, so if you were to constitutionalize a percent of market value draw, that just acts as a revenue cap on one funding source. And I'm not opposed to that idea. I think it needs some tweaks personally from where it's at now, and I'm sure that'll get discussed in the committee process. But I will say that I think it's how you allocate the resources that matters most. And why I say that, if you were to take 5% of the combined value of the fund, that would be that draw would exceed well over $4 billion a year. And I think that it's important to have an actual spending limit with, let's call it, relief valves in order to help guide the legislature, not to limit the appropriation power, but really guide to the best decisions available at the time, if that makes sense.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I might have missed this in the bill presentation, but could you speak to how this bill relates to the House Joint Resolution, and then additionally how these bills differ from what was introduced last year?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, again for the record, this is Rep. Staff. Excellent question. This is the same bill that was introduced last legislative session prior to it being amended. So this is the original version of the bill. As I stated earlier, HB 51 is conditional upon the passage of the House Joint Resolution for the constitutional amendment. So again, without the passage of the House Joint Resolution, this bill effectively doesn't do anything because it has conditional language in it. And again, the reason for that is there really isn't a reason to have a different statutory spending limit without a different constitutional limit, because it's kind of a moot concept, through the chair.
Through the chair, another set of questions. So I did not have the opportunity to sit on the House Ways and Means Committee last year, but could you just speak to why this spending cap bases itself off of GDP, and my understanding is that most other state spending caps don't look at GDP.
Through the chair to Representative Mina, yeah, the other states are going to do variations. Some do population plus inflation, like Alaska. Others do different things. I would say conceptually, again, real GDP, less government spending. And I'll go ahead and answer this question too, even though you didn't ask us. People ask me all the time why I take out government spending. That's not because I don't think government spending helps benefit gross domestic product. It does. It's just when you design a mechanism, you don't want to say, well, I can increase my own spending limit by dumping a bunch of money into government spending, if that makes sense. But there's different variations, and again, I like this metric because I believe it helps focus folks into what really matters. One, private sector growth, and two, a little bit of fiscal discipline and thinking about more long-term in terms of appropriation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I'm through the chair to Representative Stapp. Thank you for bringing this forward. Would you agree that it's because of erratic revenue streams that it's imperative that a functional spending cap is important?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Underwood, I absolutely would. It's why I bring the bill. And again, volatility is not something that you can't create control mechanisms for. And so I want to put that in. I would say the legislature in some years did a really good job of how they spent their additional revenues when our former governor, a couple of governors ago, decided to put money in the CBR and take a big chunk out of our unfunded liability for pensions. Those were wise decisions. And my thought is, like, how do you replicate those types of choices so that they're more frequent?
Do you have a follow-up? Because I do. I apologize for making you late. But I wanted to say, back on slide 7, speaking of that governor, and when they had the CBR of $4 billion, and when the new governor got elected, the CBR was $18 billion. I mean, that I don't feel like is reflected. Like, yes, we spent more, but we also saved so much more. And I think, and this came up a lot in Ways and Means last year, of, well, we need this. But I'm like, but if we were behaving correctly in the past, why do we need to create unnecessary rules on ourselves when we have this history of saving billions of dollars?
Through the chair to Chair Gray, excellent question, because historically that's been the exception and not the rule. And as much as I would love it to be the rule that everyone acted in complete an amazing fiscal responsibility every time we had a big windfall surplus. And I do. I commend the folks in the legislature and the governor in those few years where they did decide to put money into the CBR, pay off retirement liabilities and things like that. I will say that historically, when you go back, that always has not been the case. Actually, it is a good history lesson. This is how we actually got the permanent fund in the first place with our first oil windfall, through the chair.
1976. I know that the sponsor needs to leave, so I think what we'll do for now, if the committee is okay with it, is that we will put House Bill 51 aside and bring it up at a later date for invited and public testimony. And I want to thank the sponsor and intern Henry for being here today. Sure, Representative Costello.
Oh, thank you for allowing me a question. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and I just wanted to say, do you happen to know, with the budget sitting there in House Finance now, what percentage above last year's budget that budget is?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, it's a bit of a tricky question because the document I have before me is an incomplete document to be able to make that decision. So, thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here's a preview of our next meetings. On Wednesday, we will hear House Bill 97, Retail Theft Marketplace Sales Tax by Representative Fields. And on Friday, we'll hear House Bill 137, PFD Child Support by Representative Carrick. The time is now 1:35 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.